You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
Two kinds of wisdom. Now, if you've been with us here in our series of the book of James, we keep seeing this repeated theme. James 1:27, it says that you have to bridle your tongue, you have to love the poor, and you need to keep yourself unstained from the world. And so it's our words, it's our works, and it's the world. James 2:12. So speak and so act as those who will be judged by the law of liberty. Again, it's words and it's works. And so too, we saw last week, the taming of the tongue, our words, and how significant that is to have control of what we say. And then tonight, we see again works. So James just keeps conflating these two ideas. He sees them in tandem with one another. And he picks up in James 3:13, who is wise and understanding among you, let him show it. Again, this is classic James. How do we know that you're wise? It's not because we have some kind of a radar that shows it. It's that you show it. How? By his good life. We can look at your works. We can look at your deeds. We can look at your life. So it isn't just your works, but your words. It's not your words, it's your works. It's not just your lips, but your life. Let him show it by his good life, by deeds done in the humility that comes from wisdom. Wisdom. That's our topic for this evening. People are very confused on the subject of wisdom as to what it even is. And so we don't want to be using the same vocabulary but different dictionaries. We need to define our terms. And we need to define these based on the author's intent, authorial intent. What is wisdom according to the Bible? Well, for one, according to Scripture, wisdom is different than mere information. So it's not that it's in contrast or conflict or contradiction to information. It's just that it goes beyond information. You know, our world is really the information age. We have information technology, digital media. We are flooded with information. In fact, years ago, not that long, maybe a decade, they used to do a thing called radio trivia. And, you know, the DJ back on the radio, when people listen to that, you know, the DJ would be like, all right, 96.3, and we're trying to buy two tickets to Bruce Springsteen, if you can tell us who the first singer of the blue, 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 and, you know, caller number three, and then they'd be like, Brian Wilson, correct. And today, if somebody did that, you'd be like, duh. If anyone got that wrong, any question ever on any trivia thing over the radio where you can't tell if they're using their phone? Good Lord, you'd be like, that person's a fool. So we have information like crazy. We got more information than ever, better access. And yet, even though we're stuffed with information, we're starving for wisdom. How are we using this information? Are we more unified than ever? No, we're more divided than ever. I was listening to a political commentator recently where he said that the Venn diagram has gone away in the United States. So where it used to be where conservative thinkers and liberal thinkers and Republicans and Democrats would, you know, have some similarities and some agreements, now it's just completely bifurcated, separated, and we hate each other. So all this information, is it bringing us together? No, it's tearing us apart. So it's more than mere information. It's more than mere intelligence. I've met some people that are incredibly intelligent and yet incredibly foolish. I've met other people who are not that intelligent, and yet they're incredibly wise. And so, too, I've met some unintelligent fools and some intelligent, wise people. But the point is that it isn't one and the same. It's not that intelligence is equal to wisdom. Moreover, it's different than moral integrity. Again, wisdom isn't less than information. It's not less than intelligence. It's not less than integrity. But it certainly is more than all three of these things. When you think about wisdom, we're thinking about laws, but not moral laws. You know, in moral laws, you break them. Laws of wisdom, they break you. So if you're going to go out into the world and just think that I'm just going to navigate the world according to my own way of life, and well, you're going to be broken against the world. Reality has a problem of not moving, and so you bump into it. And so consequently, wisdom is a way to skillfully navigate the world. Reminds me of years ago, I was listening to a talk by a PhD in natural sciences, actually agricultural sciences, and he left his whole home and career picked up and moved to the third world, to a place of abject poverty. And he went there to teach them sustenance farming. And so he met with the indigenous people and their leaders, and he taught them, this is how we're going to do sustenance farming. So first you do the irrigation, and then you aerate the soil, and then you seed it, and this is how, and this is how you keep the pests away. And as he was explaining all this, all of the indigenous leaders were just shaking their heads, just, you know, rolling their eyes. And at the end of his presentation, he's like, so what do you think? You think we can do it? And all of them were just like, it's never going to work. And he said, yes, it will. And they were like, no, it won't. And he said, yes, it will. And they said, no, it won't. Yes, it will. No, it won't. Yes, it will. No, it won't. And this guy finally was like, well, my name has three letters after it, P, H, and D. So I'm going to have a farm, and I'm going to create this, and you're going to have to watch, and I'm going to prove it to you. And he said, sure, go ahead. Well, he went off. He made a farm, had an incredible harvest. I can't remember if it was grain or corn or what. Halfway through harvest season, word spread to the neighboring villages that this man from the West had built a farm of grain and corn and other produce. And the neighboring villages let loose all of their cows. And within the midst of a couple of days, this man's entire farm was chewed. It was, well, the cows left behind a bunch of presents for him over his farm. There wasn't a single thing to harvest. And he had to go back to those indigenous leaders with his hat in his hands. And I don't know what their expression is over there, but if they were from America, they would say, I told you so. They knew this whole time. Now, what is the problem with this guy in that story? Is it information about agriculture? No, he knew all that. Is it intelligence? No, he's very bright, super intelligent. Was it his moral integrity? No, again, he traveled across the world risking, you know, life and limb to help these people who were in poverty. What was his problem? He lacked biblical wisdom. Wisdom according to the Bible. And James's thinking comes from the Hebraic thinking of the word chokmah. This is from the Old Testament, where, for example, in Exodus chapter 31, verse 3, we see that one of the main artisans and craftsmen in regards to the building of the tabernacle, he was said to have chokmah in his artistry. That is to say, he was skilled. He had the ability to work with precious stones and metals. So too, in Psalm 107, we see that sailors have chokmah. What does that mean? What's that saying? It means that they just know the wind. They know the water. They know the waves. They know the sky. They know the seasons. They know the ropes. They know the wood. They have a certain skill with all the information that they have. And we see too, when the Messiah comes, Isaiah chapter 11, it said that he has wisdom or chokmah with regards to leadership. So some people could have the information, the intelligence, the charisma, and the integrity, and yet they don't have chokmah. They don't have skill. The ability to integrate all of these different things, which form some kind of a new property of being skillful in your field. Well, the Bible says that there is chokmah, there is skill, there is wisdom with regard to life. That there is a skillful way through which we can navigate our lives. And yet the Bible says that there's really a thesis here and an antithesis. That there is a wisdom, a skillfulness that comes from our world, the way that humans regard the world and life and everything in it. And there's a way that comes from God. From a human perspective, this is kind of like a bottom-up approach. In a bottom-up approach, it isn't just rational. Like we said, you know, it's nothing wrong with information or intellect or integrity. But in a bottom-up approach, it isn't rational, it's rationalistic. And so, as a human, I'm reasoning out from myself alone into the world. And from that, you draw certain conclusions about the meaning of life and significance and ethics, values, what's important, what do you think is integral to a good life, and so forth. Whereas the biblical view is not that it's rationalistic, where it starts with humans looking out. It's not bottom up. Instead, it's actually top down. How about that? Instead of us reasoning toward the transcendent has come down to our level and has spoken to us. And the Bible says that God has given us wisdom. And so the beginning of wisdom isn't that I need to hit the books, isn't that I need to be on Wikipedia longer, okay? That's not the key. The key, according to the wisdom literature in the Bible, is that we need to have a deep reverence and awe and love for God. We see this in Proverbs chapter 1, Ecclesiastes chapter 12. We saw it in James 1:5. If any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask God, and he will give it to you generously. And so from a biblical viewpoint, when you think about living skillfully, living the good life, it starts with God. It starts from the top down and works its way outward. Well, James starts with what we could call a wisdom of the world. He says here in verse 14, if you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your heart, don't be arrogant and so lie against the truth. Selfish ambition. Yes, this would be one way you could really rationalize from yourself outward at the world. You look at your life and you see that I've got 20, 40, 60, 80 years. And what am I going to do with that? What is of transcendent value? I'm not sure. What's going to matter in 1,000 years? Beats me. And so in the meantime, what do? You compare yourselves with others, and you also go for selfish ambition, ethical egoism. This word was originally used in Aristotelian Greek. So Aristotle, this is in the 4th century BC, it was used, quote, of seeking a self-seeking pursuit of political office by unfair means, something we know nothing of today. Because our politicians are so squeaky clean today. But apparently back in ancient Greece, these politicians would do anything they could to win elections. And so they would smile and they would work and they would politic and, you know, they would kiss people and shake babies and, you know, do everything that they could. But they would do anything they could to make an impression on other people, to look a certain way, to act a certain way, to pretend that they're somebody important, that there's somebody competent, that there's somebody who could be a leader. And what were the means? Any means necessary. Now, you might not kill somebody to get elected under this view, because that could be too much of a risk. Like if you kill a person, well, that could come back and that could bite you and then you'd be out of the race, okay? But anything that you could get away with under this view, you would in order to get your goal. Selfish ambition, that's the idea. Now, James is arguing here, not in the realm of people that don't know Christ. He's referring this principally to Christian people, which should get us to pause. Is it really possible that we, that I, could turn following Jesus Christ into some kind of a public image campaign to somehow, like, inflate my own ego? Like, is it possible I could take like the servant, sacrificial, altruistic love of Christ and that whole thing? I could somehow twist it. Could I be that sinful to somehow twist it around into something that serves me instead of others? This whole idea that was predicated on the incredible act of love by Jesus at the cross, who inaugurated this whole way of life, of giving your life away, of sacrificing for others, sacrificial love. As Jesus said, greater love has no person than this, than to lay down his life for his friends. Is it possible that somehow I could turn all that into a way to glorify myself? Answer, yeah. In fact, I do it quite often. And so do you. So James is saying bitter jealousy, that we're somehow comparing ourselves to others, selfish ambition, that we're trying to be somebody. And he calls this lying against the truth. Now, why would you call it lying? This isn't lying in the sense of openly lying. Like, when's the last time you had somebody come up to you and say, hey, I've been really bitterly jealous of you lately, and I just wanted to share that with you. Or I've been really selfishly ambitious lately. I've been thinking about myself. I've been clocking it 23 and a half hours a day, I've been thinking about my ambitions, and nobody says that. And in fact, I don't even think that's healthy. What are you supposed to say if somebody comes up and says, I've been really bitter toward you? Thanks, you know. Man, I've been really jealous of you lately. Keep that to yourself. On the other hand, you know, if you were, talking badly about a person because of your jealousy, if you were, you know, doing something that was concrete, that's something you could share. Hey, man, I shouldn't have said that. I shouldn't have done that. But just talking about how I was lying or how I was jealous, ambitious, that's not the point here. He's saying not openly lying. It's not that people really talk about this or even admit it most of the time. Even if they do, they really probably shouldn't. Instead, what he's saying here is that this is in your heart. that there's the jealousy and the ambition of the heart. And so this spews out into your life. And why is it considered lying? It's because deep down we know that we're not what we're claiming to be. Deep down we can sense that I'm putting off an image. I'm trying to be a politician. I'm trying to be smiley. I'm trying to look good. I'm trying to be a certain person, and I'm really not. And deep down we can sense that emptiness, that vacuous sense that I'm not who I'm claiming to be. It's a show, and I know it. And so whether this is something of which you're aware or something of which you're not aware at the lower level of the sin nature, this is something which is very clear, and it's animating your whole life. But is it that bad? You know, there's some things in the Bible that are wrong, and yet they're not an emphasis. You know what I'm saying? Like, the Bible says that you shouldn't use foul language a couple of times, a few times, it does. Filthy language, profane language, stuff like that. And so, yeah, the Bible teaches that. But does it emphasize it? You walk into most churches today, they would say that is the cardinal sin for you to use a bad word. But I read my Bible, and I'm like, it's just not an emphasis in the Bible. What about this? Bitter jealousy, selfish ambition. It's not really that bad, is it? You know, I have the thought, you know, God uses a little bit of ambition to motivate me. In fact, I look back on my life and I see quite clearly there was a lot of selfish ambition in there. There was a lot of jealousy. And this really moved and animated a lot of my life. And God used that to a big degree. What about that? It can't be that bad. You know, some daydreaming about being, you know, praised by people, hearing those words of praise from other people, being admired, you know, being someone who people think is real admirable and that people really look up to. Just doing a little bit of daydreaming about that. Is that really that bad? It can't be that bad. It's definitely not worse than other issues in my life, right? I mean, I got way worse issues than this. Bitter jealousy and selfish ambition, that can't really be that bad, no. Or is it that bad? Let's keep reading, verse 15. This wisdom is not that which comes down from above. Uh-oh, that means it's not coming from above. Where's it coming from? He says, but it is earthly, natural, and demonic. Great job. Oh yeah, it's not that bad. It's just a little bit of demon worship that I'm getting into and flirting with. Oh, thinking about myself and accepting praise from people. Oh yeah, like Satan would do. Congratulations. For where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, catch this, there is disorder and every evil thing. Holy crap, look at that. Talk about a biblical emphasis there. That's emphatic language. I hope you can see that. Like, oh, what's the problem to every evil thing on planet Earth? What's the problem to all the disorder, all the issues going on? Jealousy and selfish ambition. Oh, it's not that bad. Is it that bad? Yes, it's that bad. It's definitely... Years ago, I was hanging out with my buddies. We were single at the time, and it was an ice storm, and we went outside with, you know, the girls in our group, and we were trying to, like, really show off how cool and attractive we were. And so we were skidding across the ice, you know, like, you know, 20-year-old guys do. And we were skidding across the ice trying to show how impressive we were, and my buddy skidded across the ice, and he fell, and he hit the back of his head hard on the ice. And he immediately went into a seizure, and then he threw up. And he got up, and his, you know, eyes came back together, and he said, what happened? Had no memory of what happened. And we were like, dude, did you just, like, die? Like, did you have a near-death experience? Like, tell us about it. Did you see a light? What? He's just like, no, I don't remember anything. We're like, dude, we're taking you to the hospital right now. He's like, no, it's not that bad. It's not that bad. I don't need to go to the hospital. We were like, dude, you fell. You hit your head. You had a grand mal seizure. You puked. You vomited. You started speaking in Latin. Your head went 360 degrees. We're taking you to the hospital right now. And he was just like, no, it's not that bad. It is that bad. How could he not see it was that bad? He was concussed. He had a concussion, an injury to his brain. That's a serious organ in your body. And James is saying we've got a serious issue, a serious injury to our soul. Oh man, this is bad. What would this look like? Hard to say. You know, there's many different mutations of this. Even James himself says every evil thing. So to be up here and to explain what this would look like, I would have to explain every evil thing. But let's just try and think of some ways in which this might present itself. For one, this could be presented in a cutting sarcasm. Really, jealousy can't stand that someone else is doing better. And sarcasm comes from the Greek. It's the word sarx, which means flesh, and then chasm, which means to tear. So sarcasm is literally to tear flesh. It's to tear people down. It's talking, and then you're saying things which are hurtful. And then at the very end, you're saying, I'm just kidding. It was just a joke. Okay, and if you talk to me for, 4 minutes, you're going to see I'm pretty a sarcastic guy. Okay, I get it. But could we replace this from time to time with conveying a little bit of courage to people who need it? That person who's hurting, who needs a lift, and God has put me right there, and here I'm speaking words of sarcasm, so I can get kind of a half of a laugh from people, rather than having an encouraging, courageous word to people, you can do it, you can move forward. See, that would be the attitude of lifting other people up. That's the way of God, is not how great can I be, but rather how great can I make other people be. This would look like being disappointed in ourselves when other people succeed. How about the story of the guy when he found out that somebody else was being recognized for leadership in a leadership role? He locked himself in the bathroom and cried and screamed and pounded on the door because he was looked over. What? You might say, that guy's got to be a total freak. Who would do something like that? So infant, that's like something I would do when I was 5. Well, you might not do that. You might not have a temper tantrum like that, but have you ever seen somebody else succeed and all you can think about is yourself? Why wouldn't our natural, proclivity or thought be on the other person and just say, wow, I'm so happy for her. I'm so happy for him. Instead, somehow we turn other people's successes into my failure as a person. Holding long lists of problems with other people, but keeping the list pretty short on ourselves. Yeah, we talked about this last week, where we are hypersensitive toward how people move toward us. We're insensitive on how we move toward other people. And Peter, in 1 Peter 4, says that love overlooks a multitude of wrongs. What this means is that in Christian community, when there is sin, there are problems, we hurt each other, we violate each other, we're sarcastic, and we're snubbed and we're bitter, and the solution is what? The solution is confrontation, communicating respect and love, forgiveness, and not keeping lists, not holding on to grudges. The word for forgiveness is aphesis. It means to let go. Not in the sense that we are forgetting, forgive and forget. That's not biblical. That's not a biblical concept. It's in the sense that I'm letting go of what you owe me. And under this view, where it's selfish ambition, it's jealousy, I'm going to hold everything I can against you because it's leverage, it's ammunition. Being silently glad to see other people fail rather than being heartbroken. That person with whom you're in competition, when they fail, is your first thought, oh man, I just feel so much better about myself. Or is your first thought just heartache? That you see that they were moving in the right direction, that they were making an impact for Christ. And this is a tragedy, what I'm looking at here, to see them hurting, to see them wasting away. See, that would be the way of selfish ambition, of jealousy, where we can't think about anyone other than me, myself, and I. Well, how does this compare with God's wisdom? Oh, these couldn't be any more different from one another. James says, but the wisdom from above... So instead of the wisdom from below, the wisdom from above is first pure. This word pure, and it's interesting, it says first, like right at the top of the list. This can mean pure, yes, translated in that way, hagne. It can also mean free in the context of 1 Timothy 5, free from other people's sins by recognizing them for leadership, or innocent. It seems to me that when it's referring to wisdom, that this is a moral component. How could you have a wise person that's selfish and self-absorbed and narcissistic as anything? In context, that's completely against what James is talking about. Selfish ambition and also jealousy. So to be pure isn't to be selfish, it's to be selfless. That would be pure. Not some kind of moral purity ring like in Christian culture today, We're talking about being selfless toward other people. He says then, peaceable, irene. This is the word in the Old Testament, the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible. This is the word that they use to translate the Hebrew word shalom. The Hebrew word shalom is meant to imply a universal peace. So peace within ourselves, peace with us and God, and peace with us and other people. Peace. And so this could mean like an inner peace, which the Bible speaks to, definitely. It could also mean peace with others. Like we were in a fight and now we're at peace with each other. It could be both, because that term shalom, that would seem to fit with both of them. I favor the latter view, peace with others, because when you think about this, what's the context? Selfish ambition, jealousy, against other people, and so what's the peace being implied? It's not inner peace, it's not peace with God, it's peace with these other people out there. One thing I learned recently, I was taught, was whenever I enter a conflict, I always face two opponents. The other person and my ego. I'm lugging a massive ego that is sensitive and hates to be bruised and keeps records of wrongs and wants to win and is jealous and is competitive and is ambitious. And I'm lugging this whole monster into the conflict with me. The problem is I don't even see it. All I can see are the ways in which this person has offended me. Jesus said when you get into conflict, before you go and get the speck out of the other person's eye, like, hey, can I help you with that? Like, it's not your contact, a little speck in there. You pull that out. Before you get that speck out of the, oh, I got it. There it is. Yeah, got it out. Before you pull the speck out of their eye, you got to pull the log out of your own eye. That's comedy, baby. First century comedy to look at that and be like, yeah, before you get the speck, you got to get the log. That's like there's a guy walking around with a log like, let me get your speck. Hold on. It's 80 pounds, but I'll help you with the speck. And no. First, we got to look at ourselves and say, what am I bringing into this conflict? How have I, through commission, something I've done, or omission, something I failed to do, made this conflict worse? How have I backbitten this person? How have I slandered them? How have I done all a number of things that I am completely blind to? I don't see it. And Jesus says, first, before you get the speck out of their eye, first you get the log out of your own. Take the ego out of the way. Realize how I've contributed and bring peace. Yeah, that would be the sign of a wise person. Then there's gentleness. Epieikes is the term. This means, there's two words for gentleness. There's praotes or praos. This is a different word. This means not insisting on every right of letter, of law, or custom. So this would be the person who's very touchy. You shouldn't have said that. And you shouldn't have said it like that. And I didn't like the timing. And you're kind of like, you know, there's never good timing. Why is it anytime I bring up anything, I say anything, you're always criticizing how I said it and where I said it and when I said it. And it's a hypersensitivity. I move toward this person and I immediately feel like I'm walking on eggshells. Like anything I say, it doesn't matter the tone or the kindness or my heart, where my heart is, where I want to speak a word that's going to lift this person up, all of a sudden they're very sensitive. And anything I say can and will be used against me in a court of law. And it's very sensitive and demanding. And gentleness just is not this way. This is not the way of the wise person. Not to insist, to be the kind of person who just releases the debt, who just says, you know, I know you owe me that, or you could have said it better. But instead of focusing on all the coal, we look for that little nugget of diamond in what a person is saying. And so I've had situations where I had a younger man come up to me and he said, you know, I've got some things to share with you. And I was like, cool. And he had a serious look on his face. So I was like, okay, let me hear it. And so he pulled open a Word document. He had a page of things he wanted to share. I was like, wow. Okay, so he went through point after point. And I can honestly say this was 10 years ago. And he's a close friend. He's a dear friend. I can honestly say each single thing he had on the list, I can honestly say I have a clear conscience about everything on there. There wasn't a single thing that I was like, I don't think you're seeing it the right way. And I could have argued each one of those points right on down the line. I bet I could have won too. But there was a spirit of what he was saying that was directly right on, and it pierced my heart. And he said, I just feel like your heart hasn't been into it lately. And I've got all these reasons. And I was like, oh, those reasons aren't right. But if only you knew the reasons that I have for why that's right, you'd have me convicted. I'd be sent away. So to hear people when they speak into your life, instead of focusing on, you didn't say that right, you didn't put that right, it's not the right timing, search through it and try and find something in there that you're like, you know what, I needed to hear that. I think you are right on that. Epieikes. Then there's reasonable. Eupaithes. Eu means good. It's a prefix in Greek, which means good. And then paitho means to persuade or to be persuadable. If it's in the reflexive mood, eupaithes. And so this would be the kind of person that is open to reason. Yeah. You know, when you give somebody good reasons or you show them, you know, good scripture or you make good points, you know, some people, they hear that and they're like, you made a good point. And truth has kind of a resonating effect on people, and we can trust that. Some people, however, they refuse to listen to scripture. They refuse to listen to reason. They refuse to listen to evidence. They refuse to listen to loved ones, people in their lives. I've seen situations where we're sitting around a table, and the situation is so grim, so dire, and you got eight people that love this guy and care about him. Guys in tears trying to plead with him. Don't you see this? Can't you see it? And that person going through and writing off 1, 2, 3, 4, and all the way to 8. All 8 people. You're all wrong. Wow. That takes a certain level of hubris, pride, to say all 8 of these guys are wrong. And then you bring them good reasons. Oh, no, I don't believe that. I've heard people say stuff like this. Okay, I've laid out a whole case for something, and then they've said, well, I'm still not convinced. See, I don't know what to answer with that. See, if I give you evidence, what you have to do is give counter arguments, like counter evidence. Like, that's not right for this reason, or that's not right for this reason. But for me to give you all this evidence and you say, I'm not convinced, okay, I don't know what to do with your psychological state. Okay, that's between you and you. But for me, on the other hand, I don't know what to say about that. You're not convinced. I guess my question is, why? Why aren't you convinced? It could be this, eupaithes. You're not persuadable. You're not open to being persuaded. We're not working around the reason. We're working through it. See, these kind of people that aren't persuadable, it isn't the lack of evidence. It's the refusal of it. As one person said, philosopher Peter Kraft, he said, the same sun that hardens clay also melts butter. His point was, one person can see reason and all of a sudden the lights come on and it's as clear as day. Another person can see the same evidence as the same reason, and it makes them even more willful against the truth. Mercy, Elius. Yes, mercy, this is the same. I can't give any kind of commentary on this here. When we're merciful, what we're doing is we're not being uncaring. We're not being harsh, taking advantage of what we could. You owe me. We deserve that. We had one guy who moved out of our house years ago, and he came back 5 years later, and he said, where's my bike? And we were like, what bike? And he's like, in the basement. My bike was down there. And we were like, I don't know. I don't know where it is. And he's like, you guys stole my bike, didn't you? You sold it, and you stole it, and you sons of, you know, he started going, really getting all worked up. And, you know, all of us in the house were super angry about this, because we're like, first of all, we did not take it. We didn't know where it went. And one of the wise brothers there said, why don't we ask him how much the bike is worth? I said, why? He said, because we're going to give him that money. How about that? And so we said, how much is it worth? And he said, $50 or whatever. And so we gave him $50 and said, there you go. And his point was that we're going to be merciful and we're going to take away any charge that guy could have that we were trying to take from him, take advantage of him. Chuck Smith, who was a pastor on the West Coast, used to say that he liked to surprise people with grace. These are some of the most pivotal moments in your life where you know you've blown it, and it's really bad, and you're running through this like a DVR, you know, where it just keeps repeating, and it's over and over and over. How could I do that? Why would I do that? You know, is this a bad dream? Is it a nightmare? I blew it. And you sit down with an older, mature believer, and you're expecting the hammer, and instead they give you a hug. Mercy. I can't tell you. This has happened multiple times in my life. Very life-changing. Very unique. and something we don't experience in the world. Everything is tit for tat, and we're trying to take, we're being exacting, getting what we deserve, and to show mercy, surprise people with grace. And full of good fruits, which I take to mean that these are qualities grown by God, qualities of character. And then he says, unwavering, diakritos. So the alpha privative is not, like theist, atheist, not a theist. And then dia is between, and then krino is judge. And so one way of taking this, especially if you adopt this view, I'm arguing that it's between people, is that you're the kind of person who's impartial. When you're deciding between people, you have a kind of judgment that is fair, that is judicious, you might say. This could be in conflict situations. This could be when you're making judgment calls, when you're trying to adjudicate between two different people and two different arguments, and you're trying to be fair is what you're doing. Unwavering, that you're going to stick with God's truth, even if there's a cost. And then finally, he says, without hypocrisy. And hypokritos, so again, the prefix not, and hypokritos, hypocrite. This was originally used of the play actors. They would go out and they would do a performance, and then they would go backstage in ancient Greece and they would switch masks. So they would go out and be, you know, and they'd go back out and be like, and have their acting mask on. And the Bible picks up on this language for people who are faking it. They're going out there with a mask on and being all, and they like to act. So they talk and they talk this big game and we talk and then they go backstage and then they change masks. And we're always wondering who is behind the mask. Who's the real person underneath there? Signs of hypocrisy. It could be outright lying. Oh man. I remember one guy we had living with us in our Christian rooming house. He couldn't make rent. He was, you know, 2 or 3 months behind, and we said, dude, you gotta move out. We're sorry, you know. And so we moved him out, and he was still coming around our Bible study, and one day he showed up and he said, hey man. He said, the worst thing just happened. I said, what? And he said, there was a gang that came through and they shot my cousin and they shot his little baby in the face. And I was like, oh my God. And he said, and then they were following me all the way back here. And we were like, dude, we gotta take care of you here. So, you know, we started putting him in the house, moving him right back in. And then all of a sudden, one of us started thinking about that a little bit more. And we were like, wait a minute. A baby was shot in the face? What was the name of the baby? And he was like, such and such. And punched it into Google. Nothing came up. What was the name of your cousin? So-and-so. Nothing. I'm like, if a grown man and a baby were killed, like that would pop up on the news. And so we started to press this a little bit further. He had made the entire thing up. And to have such egregious lying, like how could you lie on that level? Some people get really shocked by that. How could you be such a fool to lie? People lie. And it's a sign of hypocrisy. We should be able to push a little bit deeper, ask questions, and realize that none of that was true. Sometimes it's just inconsistency with people who are hypocrites, where you're like, see, that just doesn't fit. And sometimes when you're pointing out inconsistencies, there are these tenacious responses. We like to call them the fireworks. These are self-defense mechanisms, where you're like, see, that doesn't fit with that. And then all of a sudden, the person's just like, ah! You know, and they yell at you, and you're like, whoa, geez, no bad, whatever, sorry. And basically what that's doing is teaching them that whenever they yell at you, that you'll leave them alone. And it's actually a very immature way of relating, because it's not getting into deeper issues. Who is this person? I know. I want to know them on a deep level. Smoke screens, finger pointing, all this different stuff. Yeah, this is basically signs that I want to get the focus off of myself, and I want to make up some kind of a personage of somebody I'm not. Well, James closes, he says, the seed whose fruit is righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. That's an interesting conclusion to this section. Why do you suppose he compares character transformation and becoming a lover of wisdom, a practitioner of wisdom? Why would he compare this with agriculture? Seems to me that he's saying here, this is a process, and all of us are in process. That this is going to take some time. This is going to take some work. Just like, you know, aerating a farm. That's going to take some work. And we're going to have to harvest the fruit. this is going to be a time of patience. We're going to have to trust that that crop is coming up. And the same thing is true with wisdom. Day to day, I don't know if you feel this way. I don't really feel like a wiser person. You might not feel that way either. And it might be the same as looking at your crop. All you see is dirt, and you don't see the seed coming up. And yet you come back a week later, 2 weeks later, a month, you know, 6 months later, and all of a sudden you got a tall crop of corn. And you might not feel any different. But other people looking in, they can see the change palpably. Very real that this person has changed. And so this is all the more reason to avoid selfish ambition and jealousy, but to encourage people who are making the effort, who are trying to grow and not being able to see the results necessarily. Well, if I could leave you with one thing here tonight, you might be asking the question as we look at these character qualifications. If anybody here is saying, you know, oh yeah, I just don't struggle with any of those. Well, why don't you go to the perfect church down the street where all the perfect people hang out? This is a real church where the real sinners hang out, and we need help. How on earth can we change into people like this? Seems pretty scary. I don't know. Well, the answer to the question may be in the question itself. How on earth can we change? See, from a biblical view, we don't change from an earthly source. See, our problem is me, myself, and I. Think of this statement. I need to change my problems, but my biggest problem is me. And so I have a flawed person trying to change a flawed person. What we need is someone outside, transcendent of humanity, to come in and to start to work with us and to grow us. As I said, over time. This is not overnight. Any more than a crop of plants shoots up overnight on a farm. But this is something that's going to take time. And we need, I guess what I'm saying is, we need Jesus Christ. What I'm saying is, you need Jesus Christ in your life. Paul said in 1 Corinthians 1:30, when he's talking about wisdom, he says, God has united you with Jesus Christ. For our benefit, God made him to be wisdom itself. Christ made us right with God. What you need is to have Jesus Christ come into your life. That's what you need, plain and simple. If you're the kind of person who's feeling like, oh, I could never change to become a loving person like this, a wise person like this, yes, you can. But it needs to start, just like with a harvest, it needs to start with a seed and a plant. It needs to start with a birth. And that's basically admitting, I need Christ to come into my life and give me a new heart, a new birth. And all of a sudden, he's going to start to nurture you and work with you and grow you into the kind of person that is like this. And over weeks, months, years, you're going to see he's starting to change your life in ways that you never would have thought possible.
Thanks for listening. This has been a Dwell Community Church production.